We welcome you again to the Milt Rosenberg podcast. And it is, as a matter of no accident, Milt Rosenberg speaking. Speaking to an old friend, Sam Peltzman, one of my buddies from the University of Chicago. But we were not in the same departments. I, a mere psychologist, you, a practitioner of that particularly mysterious science called economics.
Yes. Science.
Who was
discipline.
Discipline would be better. Who was it that called it the dismal science?
Carlyle. Thomas Carlyle.
It's Carlyle, not Ricardo. I thought it was
No, it wasn't Ricardo. It was Carlyle.
What did he really mean by that?
Well, he was referring to Malthus, who was the celebrated economist of the day and of course, predicted that we'd all either starve or live at subsistence, which was a dismal prediction.
Mm-hmm.
So that's but it's the name is stuck because economics in general or economists are the people who take the punch bowl away at the party.
Of course, Malthus was also a reverend doctor.
Yes.
Was I guess in the Anglican Church, and as such, he was also doing some theodicy, that being the branch of theology which concerns itself with the question of why or how a decent and lovable and loving God can allow mankind to suffer. He said, ultimately, it is to the good of mankind because disease and war thin out the population,
putting off
the time when we face the catastrophe of far more demand than any possible supply.
Right. He called those the positive checks.
Yeah. Was there ultimately anything to that?
Ultimately, well, the period between him and us has seen the greatest growth in wealth and per capita income in the history of mankind.
And in agricultural production,
yeah, so,
which he was
and
very
in agricultural.
About.
So up to now, no, the question is how long is your horizon?
Yeah, there must be an upper limit.
No.
No.
No, there mustn't be enough. Why should there be? I mean, that was his point, and he's been proved wrong for 200, you know, getting on to 200 years.
Well, I mean, an upper limit in natural resources and agricultural productivity, though, of course, apart from developing the world much more than it has yet been developed, we may ultimately have yet other worlds or planets to develop.
Well, pure speculation. The facts, which are the only thing I care to look at, is growth has proceeded at 1-2% per person per year for that whole period, and there's no sign that there's an upper limit to that.
You are then, my old friend, actually a devotee of Sergeant Friday, who used to say on his famous television program, "All I care about, ma'am, is the facts."
Yes, that's right.
What facts are crucial in your calculation?
Oh, it depends on, of course, it depends on the problem. The one we're discussing now is the long-run growth of income per person.
That's a pretty good one to keep in mind.
And that's an important one. And if you look at the slope of that line, it's pretty steady in percentage terms.
No matter what the political and or economic system?
There are fluctuations over the short run, but if you take the very long perspective, it's 1-2% per capita in what we call the developed world, pretty much in a straight line.
The developed world.
Yes.
How much of the world is that?
In population, less than half, but in production, 70 or 80%.
What's the perspective for the other half?
It depends what you're looking at. If you're looking at Asia, which used to be less developed,
mm-hmm.
it's now developed. China is not part of the developed world yet, but it's going to get there. It's getting there very fast.
It's not part of the developed world
no,
yet?
No, you're talking about a country whose average per capita income is on the order of Mexico, which is not part of the developed.
Curiously, now.
But if you look at the rich parts of China, which is the coast and
the coastal
Beijing,
cities,
Shanghai, they're getting there. They are getting there.
Something that they are getting somewhere.
It's just, you know, you have still have half of the population in the rural areas. They've been moving to the coast, but their incomes per person are considerably lower. China has a huge gap between geographies.
For the ordinary American consumer, the most relevant observation in recent years is that when you really look at almost anything you buy, look at the label, it turns out it is, quote, made in China. Brooks Brothers, where I buy my shirts.
Yes.
And I bought some the other day after about a year. And they used to be made in, I think, Honduras or in Colombia or someplace, now made in China.
Yes. There's a complication involved in all of that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what your Apple, if you have an Apple phone, or I don't know what it says on the back, but it's irrelevant. A lot of manufacturers.
My cell phone is certainly made in China.
Well, it's complicated. It's complicated. What's developed in the last, and China's part, a big part of this, what's developed in a lot of manufacturing product kind of industries is what's called global supply chain, where when you get to the final product, let's say an iPhone, half of the money spent for the iPhone ends up in the United States. The other half is all over the world, including China, where it's put together. What it's done is it assembles components that are made in Japan and in Singapore and places like this, and the United States, some of them.
But they're not yet making the components.
Huh? Excuse me?
They're not yet making the components.
No, the components are made all over. They're making some of them,
mm-hmm.
and they're doing final assembly. But the what we call value added in each country is a fraction of the total. I don't know about your Brooks Brothers suit, but I wouldn't be surprised.
What is a suit? Merely a shirt.
A shirt. Well, that gets that. But if you have any design feature, any special textiles involved. It's not clear all that's made in China, no matter what the label says.
Are you thereby sort of exemplifying what should be meant by the, quote, global economy?
It's increasingly becoming that way in goods production. Now, services is a more complicated area. But in goods production, it's increasingly becoming globalized in the supply chain sense. That you don't – when it says made in some place – yeah, that doesn't have a clear meaning anymore.
Let's introduce you to our audience. You are, of course, well known to the audience that we had on our regular radio program, but now we're talking to a somewhat different audience, spread over the world, in fact. And you've not been on this new series called The Milt Rosenberg Show for some time, or at all, since we began. This is about our 67th or 68th taping, in fact, mm-hmm. of such a discussion. You are, in fact, not merely professor of economics at the Booth School of Business at the University of Chicago. Your doctorate is from the University of Chicago.
That's correct, yes. A long time ago.
And one of your professors was a guy named Friedman, I think, or something.
Milton Friedman was my first teacher.
Your very first teacher.
Yes, in the fall of 1960, I walked into my first class at the University of Chicago.
What was your...
And it was Milton Friedman.
What did you think of the professor the first day?
Excuse me?
What did you think of the professor on that first day?
Oh, he was quite formidable.
Why? Why and how?
Let me preface it by saying he was a very nice guy. As humble and as friendly to the janitor as he was to the King of Sweden.
Also very funny when he chose.
When he chose to be very funny and very quick-witted. But in the classroom, he was a hard taskmaster.
Mm-hmm.
he had a technique where he'd have your name written on index. He'd have every student's name. We're talking about 60 students. Everybody had to take this class in their first year. He had all their names on index cards, and he would pick up the Wall Street Journal, read something, and he would flip through the cards, and he'd say, "Peltzman, what do you think of that?" And you had better have an answer. He did not suffer fools gladly in the classroom. So that was life with Milton Friedman.
You know, it sounds very much like Professor whatever his name was, played by John Houseman in The Paper Chase.
I didn't see that.
At Harvard Law.
I didn't see that one, but if could well be a Milton Friedman was his model.
Friedman, you know, and I lived in the very same building.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I still live there. Milton went on after some years to live in San Francisco.
Yes.
With his association at, I guess, the Hoover Institution. And when did he pass away now? It could be.
Oh, it's about almost 10 years.
About 10 years, seems right.
10 years, yeah.
But I was starting to do the regular radio program, and Milton was a rather frequent guest, and he was fascinated by radio. We would go down there when we did it together, by his coming from his apartment at the top of the building down to mine in the middle of the building, knock on the door, and we'd go to my car, and we'd drive down there.
Oh, I see.
And he wanted to know everything about, well, I guess he wanted to know everything about everything.
Yeah.
And he learned a good deal about modern commercial radio by poking around this place and asking me questions.
Well, that's sounds like him.
What, in fact, is the Friedman insight? Is there a lasting particular insight other than there's no such thing as a free lunch that comes from him and lasts as a truth in economics?
Well, he was a very diverse, he had a very diverse portfolio, so to speak. He made absolutely seminal contributions to the study of money, the monetary system. His Monetary History of the United States is a lasting masterpiece there. But on the other side, he taught us price theory, so that has nothing to do with monetary economics per se. And I would say his one notable contribution there is the concept of permanent income as opposed to transitory income. It used to be a very a conundrum about how it was that people who were at the bottom consumed more than they made. You wondered about that. A lot of economists wondered about that. He had a very simple explanation for it, which is that the income fluctuates, and at any one moment in time, people at the very bottom can expect perhaps in the future to go up, and they won't adjust their consumption day by day with what their income is. So he introduced the concept of permanent income. What you should focus on is income over that people can expect over a long period of time, and it's turned out to be a very useful construct in many different contexts, including money and macroeconomics, but also in other contexts. So he made, and that was just two. I mean, you know, the rest of them are not that well known, but he was and of course he's known outside of economics for his forceful advocacy of markets. And another of his, I would say, professional accomplishments was keeping that torch alive at a very hostile time, which is when I got into the profession.
Hostility from what source?
From the rest of the profession. He was viewed, you know, he became ultimately an icon, a public icon. And
through his book, particularly Capitalism and Freedom.
Capitalism and Freedom made him a public icon. Yeah. He eventually got the professional respect that he deserved. He got the Nobel Prize, for example. But when he was entering the profession and when I came in, which would have been 15 years later, the center of gravity in economics was quite left of center. Socialism was the wave of the future. We were bedazzled by growth in the Soviet Union. Big mistake, enormous mistake. But not there was a certain optimism that economists would enter a brave new world in which they would be employed by the policymakers to lead the rest of us to down the golden path.
Give me some names. Who are we talking about in Western economics?
Well, we're talking about a spectrum. Depends on which part of the profession. Yeah. But if you look at his big rival at the time was Samuelson, Paul Samuelson. Mm-hmm. Who was he would probably define the center of the profession at that time. I like to quote something from Samuelson wrote the
famous textbook.
Famous yeah. textbook. It was the wildly bestseller of the time. It went through almost 15 editions or something. Mm-hmm. I like to quote from the 12th edition. I happen to know it because I give this quote when I make the point that I'm about to make. There's a chapter, there's a mandatory chapter in every textbook, of at least of that era, on what was called comparative economic systems. It'll give you a sense of where the profession was. I taught that course once. It was, here's capitalism, here's socialism, here's something in between, and they're all three kind of equal, and what's the future going to bring? It's going to bring about some amalgamation of all of that. So here is from the 12th edition of Samuelson. There is no doubt that, I'm not giving the exact quote because I don't have it in front of me. I would have brought it if you had warned me that you were going to discuss this. There is no doubt that the Soviet Union is a great engine of economic growth. Hmm. The only problem with it is basically it kills people to get where it's going. That's a problem. When was that written? By Samuelson. Well, in a book that bore his name. 1985. At 6 years later, the Soviet Union was on the scrapbook of history. But it's a lingering symptom of where the profession was. Anybody who was telling us economists, I'm talking about the center of the economics profession, in 1960 when I got into this, that you just, you know, the best way to proceed is not to proceed. You were a nut. You were an outsider. And if you deviated from Keynesianism, which is, oh, there's a little problem of the business cycle, well, you just spend. You know, the chairman of President Kennedy's Council of Economic Advisors was brought in to, quote, fine-tune the economy. Any little deviation from the right path, and we economists have a way of fixing it. Friedman was the outsider.
At some point in your life, you worked at the Council of Economic Advisors.
I did indeed. You have my bio there
yeah,
somewhere.
Looking
somehow,
at it.
Yes.
What year? What year was that?
It's 1970 to 71.
So what did they represent at that time?
The beginning of the disillusion with that view of the world. I mean, it culminated, my departure actually was, fortuitously, was the dividing line between that era and the current era. 2 days after I left, Nixon imposed wage and price controls on a peacetime economy for the first time in history. It reflected the frustration with things were not working out the way the center of the economics profession was telling us they should work out. We were getting inflation, we were getting unemployment, all at the same time. That shouldn't happen. You know, we could fine-tune these things. Mm-hmm. But we couldn't. And Nixon panicked, or his advisors, some of his advisors. I mean, I was inside, so it's not important who was on which side at this point, 40 plus years later. But enough of his advisors panicked, and he panicked. He was going to have an election next year. It was a wrong move. It was also an admission that the previous policies had failed, and it got worse. It got much worse.
What you've just said gives me a basis for being a little rash, and noting that there are many who speculate, people in a position whose speculations matter, that a coming Nobel laureate in economics will be Sam Peltzman.
Well, that's very flattering.
Of the university.
I don't wait up nights in October waiting for
you
this.
You are a professor at the University of Chicago, which has, I think, the largest number of Nobel laureates in economics in all the world.
Yes, and we got a couple last year.
We did indeed. But it's worth noting as well that one of your main interests in your career, maybe since you served the Council on Economic Advisers, or maybe it had already begun before that, is the role of government in attempting to regulate, control, and keep active and effective the private economy.
Yes, no, that's been my whole life's work, actually.
And there is something known as the Peltzman effect, which argues that from this kind of governmental interest and involvement often comes disaster.
Well, not exactly. That label has been applied to my study of automobile safety regulation.
Yeah, which begins with seatbelts, doesn't it?
Well, the safety equipment seatbelts generally.
And what's the finding there?
The fact that I claim to have found in 1975, you're talking again 40 years ago, was that there was no effect on death rates on the highway. And further, that this was the net of two effects. One, that the drivers fared better, but people outside, pedestrians and so on and so forth, fared worse, and the two things offset. And that's become known as the Peltzman effect. I view it as merely an application of basic economics.
How so?
Well, it says if you reduce the cost of something to somebody, they're likely to do more of that. And what the signal or the effect of the safety devices, which work, by the way. I mean, nothing in what I'm saying will advise your listeners to unbuckle their seatbelts. In fact, they should. They work. But the fact that they work makes driving less risky and leads people to take more risks. Now, it's also called that because I was the first one to look at this question systematically. Had nobody else looked at it, it would have just been one more finding. But it was provocative enough to lead to hundreds of, I'm not sure hundreds, but a lot of similar studies in a lot of different contexts, I might add, not just safety.
Well, does it apply more broadly? To take a psychologist's version of it, what you are asserting, what is asserted by the Peltzman effect broadly, is that a sense of security breeds comparative recklessness.
Yes, yes. There is a psychologist who's contributed to this literature on automobile safety specifically. So it's had wide application, but obviously it applies to the banking sector.
How so?
The banking sector is regulated for what reason? To make the system safer. Safer. What is the vehicle by which it does it? Well, the one which, by the way, my first teacher, Milton Friedman, favored, It's one government intervention he favored was deposit insurance. Okay, you tell a depositor, you and me, you do not have to worry about the safety of your bank.
You've got FDIC.
Right, we have the FDIC. It will, whatever happens, will assure. What does that do to the incentive that the bank has to take risks? It gets its deposits basically by paying the treasury bill rate. And if it wins a risky bet, its stockholders get all the upside. If it loses, the depositors are made whole. They're willing to supply endless amounts of capital at very cheap rates. There's a very powerful incentive to take risks. And lo and behold, we wake up one day, and boy, they've done that. They've taken risks, haven't they? Right? So it applies very broadly.
Does that apply, for example, to the great housing collapse, which generated what was our latest recession and or possibly depression?
Let's go back. The desire to invest in something called subprime mortgages is directly related to what we're talking about. It is the risky investment of choice that a good banker will make faced with these kind of incentives. Paying people outrageous bonuses for taking risks is exactly what a bank should be doing facing these kind of incentives. Having the uninsured depositors and the bondholders of the bank bailed out reinforces that signal. So now we try to sit on it with a Dodd-Frank Act, with various kinds of regulation. Where do you think this is ultimately headed? It's headed to another crisis. Hmm. It has to of the same type. Could happen. In fact, it could be a repeat. Through the housing market. That really hasn't been fixed. We still have Fannie and Freddie to pick up the subprime mortgages. You know, so let us just say the Peltzman effect has lots of applications.
So what would Peltzman recommend with regard particularly to banks and their failure?
The question, what are your objectives here? My objective, the objective that I would throw on the table would be when a crisis happens, when a banking, a financial crisis happens, we should, because it's going to happen in any state of the world, we should minimize the harm to the wider economy and we should minimize the cost to the taxpayer. If that's your objective, ultimately the only way to realize it is to change the incentives or to at least introduce less incentive to take risk or more penalty for the consequences.
How do you do that?
I'm kind of a hawk on bank capital. The banking system is a very leveraged system. It uses $1 of capital of its own funds, of the stockholders' funds, to invest $10 worth of assets or more. I mean, at the height of the craziness, it was $30 of assets, Those $30, a good chunk of them are either or $10, whatever it is. They're either explicitly insured or implicitly insured by the too big to fail bailout syndrome. You have to change that ratio. You have to make let me go back. Historically, before we had deposit insurance, typical bank had $2 of capital against $8 of other assets instead of one against nine. The reason for going back to that kind of a ratio is more compelling today than it was then. because we do have deposit insurance, and we didn't then. They were protecting themselves from bank runs and so on and so forth with that extra dollar. If it was good enough for the 1920s, it's good enough today. We should double the required capital. They're talking about incremental increases, and there have been increases. But I favor a radical return back to the future.
One of the early surprising, or at least worrying, undertakings by the Obama administration was the, quote, bailing out of General Motors. Yes. General Motors was essentially bankrupt, and we put a vast amount of federal money in to buoy them up.
Yes.
Supposedly, we've now got all that money back. Whether we really have,
well,
I don't know.
Well, not quite. It's got some of it back.
Was that a policy you approved of at the time?
No.
Why not?
No. I generally don't approve of having the government pick where capital ought to be allocated. Having said that, it hasn't worked out badly. I mean, you know, you have to look at the facts of the situation, and General Motors is now viable, and you never can play back the alternative, which is what would have happened if they hadn't bailed it out. It's not clear the General Motors would have gone away. You can go back and also say, if they did intervene, what would the way they intervened have been better if they did it one way as opposed to another way? But on the whole, if you asked me looking back, has it worked out badly? I would say no.
If you want to replay history and ask whether things might have turned out differently if one particular or another particular event had not occurred, with regard to the matters we're now discussing, my mind goes inevitably way back to the 1930s and the NRA.
Yes.
Explain what the NRA was. And do you think that was the beginning of the process?
It's an acronym for the National Recovery Act.
Exactly.
The National Recovery
Roosevelt's
Administration.
Innovation back in 1934?
It was his first. It was his first reaction, big reaction to the economic downturn. I would put aside the banking. You know, there was the bank holiday, and he introduced deposit insurance in 1933 as an emergency measure. In terms of a lasting impact, that's probably been more important. But in the year or two after that, he decided to cartelize the economy. This is a strain that was running through the world at the time.
It's in Italian fascism.
Yes,
very strongly.
Yes. It's basically the Italian fascist model, a corporativist model.
Syndicalism. It was
syndicalism. Yes. The labor and management and government would work together to produce a better outcome. So industries were cartelized. The antitrust laws were suspended. They were brought one by one to Washington, and they figured out codes industry by industry to reduce competition, which would be good for business, and to keep workers' wages from falling, which would be good for the workers, and prosperity would follow. Well, it didn't follow, and the Supreme Court basically ruled that it was unconstitutional, and he went in a different path after 1935.
But it sets a kind of an orientation or an attitude which persists, that is government involvement in regulation of important sectors of the economy. One that you've also been quite interested in is essentially the pharmaceutical industry.
Yes, yes, yes. And the healthcare is probably the
more
best,
broadly, yeah.
More broadly, the best example of where that model is being applied today.
How does the Peltzman analysis approach the healthcare model?
Well, it does more broadly when health. But I don't want to be pushed into a corner as saying that if you provide health care for people, they'll drink themselves to death. It's true, but it will lead us down a path that gets away from a lot of the
sense of security fosters recklessness.
Yes, but just as I don't want to say that you shouldn't wear seatbelts. Uh-huh. I don't want to say that you shouldn't get health care, you know, or that it's not a serious issue.
So what do you want to say?
About which aspect of it?
Well, let's stay with pharmaceuticals for a moment.
Yes. What aspect of pharmaceuticals? They've been a source of increases in longevity and a source of political interference at the same time for a long time. The one aspect of it that I studied myself was the introduction of new drugs, new pharmaceuticals.
And the fact that introduction is delayed by testing requirements.
Yes, and that continues. That syndrome continues, and it's led to a profound change in the way that industry is structured, where the main issue becomes, once you have a good drug, the main issue is how do you get it through Washington? The innovator is not doing that. It's some big drug company doing that.
But so is there a disadvantage that follows thereupon?
Oh, tremendous.
What's the nature of that disadvantage?
Tremendous. Well, it takes 10 years to get through that process, of which the last two or three are you have a good drug, you want to get on the market, you're ready to go, you have to get through the food and drug, what's called stage three of a new drug application, which is you got to get by a committee. The committee then has to make a recommendation. The recommendation has to be looked at very carefully by an agency which is very loath to take any risk at all. That's every new drug has to go through that. Of the ones that are in the pipeline, that process may cut off maybe 1 out of 10 that are bad in some dramatic sense. 1 out of 10 that are bad, maybe 1 out of 2 or 3 of those are bad in a dramatic sense, which is if they were put on the market, they'd kill people. Seriously harm people. So basically, you are subjecting every single new drug to a process that will necessarily delay their intake into the market by 2 or 3 years to weed out 1 or 2 out of 20 bad ones. Those are daunting odds. You take something like the advances in heart disease. Here's the nub of the problem. There are hundreds of thousands of people fewer dying today from first heart attacks than were maybe 30 or 40 years ago. About a quarter of that has been attributed to the drugs they can give that do that. Every one of those is new in that long interval. So you're talking about 100,000 people a year maybe who are saved by those drugs. Every one of those drugs, when it was new, came on the market a couple of years after it could have come on the market if you didn't have this bureaucratic process.
And because of
now,
that delay.
Can you just think about that? That is tens of thousands of people. There's no good way, no other good way to put this, Milt.
Yeah.
Killed.
Dying earlier than
killed
they would have, exactly.
Because they didn't have access to those drugs. For what? For what benefit? Trivial. It turns out that nothing like that magnitude of people plausibly saved by bad drugs. When we go back to the history of when we had these bad drugs on the market. And on top of that, we've had only a minor reduction in the incidence of bad drugs that actually make it to the market. So they go through that 2 or 3 year process, get on the market, and then, and only then, do we find out that they're bad.
I'm always interested in cross-national comparisons. There's a line, the opening line of Lawrence Stern's Sentimental Journey is, they order these things differently in France. Do they order these things differently
they used to,
in France,
but,
Germany, etc.?
But there is a worldwide convergence in these matters, number one. There's still a less tendency to be as restrictive
as we are
elsewhere as we are. Mm-hmm. However, we are the pot of gold in the pharmaceutical market. The only, so far, it's going to change inevitably. So far, the only market without serious price controls.
Since we're in this broad area, do you have any general Peltzmanian view of so-called, colloquially called, Obamacare?
We're getting it. You mentioned Obama. I think that's the first time I've heard the name. And I should preface everything I'm going to say from this point mm-hmm. on. Your audience should know I'm not a big fan. I had high hopes, but I'm not a big fan. And Obamacare is, while it gets a lot of people excited, is not the primary reason for that. But it's a bad idea. It's taking a small problem and turning the whole healthcare industry upside down, and with a syndicalist kind of model, in ways that are going to be very costly for now I think that's all intended, by the way. I think that the desired outcome is to have the government run the whole healthcare system. It is not to take care of this problem of uninsured uninsured people. I don't think it's necessary to have the government run the whole healthcare system to achieve that minor objective. So I'm not friendly to it. Let's put it that way. It's been partly, although I'd have to emphasize the partly. It's been partly responsible for the sluggish economic recovery that we've had. It's raised the cost of employing workers. It's had a lot of short-run deleterious effect. In the long run, it's going to make the system more expensive. It was a system which layered on extra demand, not just in the sense of making people insured, but dictating what kind of policies. The government's going to buy condoms now, you know, all this kind of stuff. It's layering it over a system whose basic problem is a cost problem, a problem that there's no check on rising costs. It's going to make that problem worse. So I'm not a big fan.
Clearly.
To say the least.
That is quite clear. Are you a big fan of our economy and its future? And for that matter, are you a big fan of, that is, are you more or less sanguine in your expectations concerning the world's economy and the economic future?
Yes and no. There are some problems that have to be grappled with. I think the potential is there. Potential is there. It's here, it's there, it's everywhere. Even Africa, which was less developed for a longer time than it needed to be, is now stirring a little bit. The potential is there. The issue is, will we realize that potential? And on that issue, I'm not that sanguine, at least right now. All of the developed countries are dealing with the after effects of 2008 and 2009, and it is not clear at this point which way they are going to go. The problem is a structural one. We're getting older. Older people get pensions and they get health care, and in most cases, in most of the world, most of the developed world, they get them from the government. So the government has tried to deal with the crisis of 2008 and 2009, as their Keynesian advisors told them, by spending more money. All right. So and widening the deficit. Those deficits have not been closed in the 6 years since that process started, and because we're getting older, they're going to get worse. All right. And so, but the capital market is not going to supply infinite amounts of credit to these governments. So the fiscal path is unsustainable. And how we deal with that unsustainability is a key to where we're going in the future. Are we going to validate it by raising taxes? If so, I think we're headed for a more dismal future. Are we going to reduce spending and deal with the demographics in a different way than we have in the past? This is more a challenge for Europe than it is for us. If the answer to that is yes, then I'm more optimistic.
We started early in our conversation today, and we're coming to a close by virtue of the exigencies of the clock. We started with a reference to Milton Friedman. It is true that, don't you think, that essentially his view was he never saw a tax reduction he didn't like.
He liked tax reductions because he believed that they starved the beast.
Yeah.
So even if there was a deficit, that's good, because his view was ultimately the legislature will deal with the deficit by reducing spending. I don't think that that's clear at all. I think it's true in some ultimate sense, because they won't be able to borrow, or they'll have to print money and deal with inflation, and they'll worry about that consequence. But I don't think there's a lot of evidence for the start.
So you do not see general tax reduction as a panacea for such economic ills as we have?
No, I do not. I think he was very clear that when you look at the size of government, you should focus on what it spends.
Yeah.
He favored tax reductions because he thought it would reduce spending. But the important variable is spending. And with that, he and I would be on the same page. Yeah. With respect to that observation.
Still, you remain, as I was suggesting earlier, as I was characterizing earlier, you remain essentially optimistic about the long-run future of the human economy in the world.
Well, I think we're going to get things right, but we could screw up. There's no doubt about that.
Somebody already
have in many ways. But
you think Keynesianism in itself was a screw up?
I think it was the triumph of hope over experience. If you look at the actual facts, what evidence there is? I'm talking about professional evidence there's very little. There's very little. But that's what we were raised on as children. And when faced with a crisis, we tend to crawl back into our womb. I was actually shocked at how unrigorous the stampede toward Keynesianism in my profession was after 25 years of being weaned away from it. But yeah, the center of the profession remained Keynesian. That was not a triumph of, that was not something that Friedman was able to ultimately
change. And in Yeats's great line, the center did not hold.
No, the center basically held. It just was wrong.
But it doesn't
and
hold.
Remains wrong.
Does it still hold now?
Governments are
attracted to the possibility,
yes,
of saving things by spending money.
I would say that there's been a permanent shift back toward Keynesian solutions to these kind of problems, but based on, again, no good evidence.
So the high spending of the current American administration is part of an international trend, you say?
It is indeed. The U.S. is actually in better shape than other countries. That's because the 2010 election was a corrective. Spending growth actually has slowed. We still have a problem. Now, don't get me wrong. We have a demographic problem, and we're going to spend more on it now with Obamacare, and Social Security and all of that. All of those issues are going to get worse. We will have to deal with them, but we have some more wiggle room now than the rest of the world.
Sam Peltzman, everything you've said in the range of topics that we've run through has been enticing, and we could build a program on each of them. And I thank you very much for joining us today.
It's been my pleasure, Milton.